You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Attention, people of Earth! Looking for a way to kill half an hour every week?
Try the Flopcast! It's a silly podcast about cartoons, music, comics, movies, obscure pop culture from the 70s and 80s, and chickens.
Join us! Bring coffee!
We're on the ESO Network.
And we're at flopcast.net.
And of them where you do not realize you are in an interstellar conveyance. You are already outside the atmosphere of your own planet.
Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack! Monster attack!
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. And we've got a fun one for you this week. It comes from one of our more popular British studios. No, it's not a Hammer film, but it's just like a Hammer film because this was a studio that tried to be a lot like Hammer, and then they were very successful in doing it. I know as a kid growing up, I mistaken a lot of their films for Hammer Productions, as many of you my age probably did as well. Now, this comes to us from Amicus Productions, and it's called From Beyond the Grave, and it'll be celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. I saw this film when it first came out in 1974, and I was a sophomore in college at the University of North Carolina. And you've heard me speak many times about the little movie theater on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill that would show Hammer films and, Amicus films as well. And I saw it there in this little theater. Again, it was sort of my home away from home. And, whenever I wanted to just sort of escape from the world and drop into my world of monsters, this was the perfect place to do it. This is an anthology movie, as Amicus is well known for doing. And this would be the last anthology film that they would do. Now, you might remember some of the other ones that they did. We've done a couple of them here on Monster Attack, beginning with Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which had come out in 1965. I think Mark and I did that, I believe, in season one, if I'm not mistaken. That might be a good one to go back and revisit sometime soon, because one of my favorites growing up, if you remember way back then, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors greatly influenced the way in which I approached a screenplay when I was writing my own screenplays. I loved the style of storytelling that Amicus had with their anthology films, and they do it here. Some of the other ones they did was Torture Garden, The House That Dripped Blood. We haven't done that one yet. Tales from the Crypt, the 1972 film. Asylum, which we did do a few seasons ago. And The Vault of Horror, that's one that's on the list as well. All of these anthology movies I just love the storytelling on that. And From Beyond the Grave is no disappointment. And the sort of nice thing about From Beyond the Grave and Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, you've got the end and the beginning, and they both start in the same way. A series of vignettes that are tied together by one common thread. And in both the films, that common thread is another favorite of ours, and that is actor Peter Cushing. He will be the guy that introduces all of the segments. Well, not necessarily, now in this one, he doesn't necessarily introduce the segments, but he ties them all together. He's the glue that holds this movie together. And, what better guy to do it? Of course, this is 3 years before he would do one of his very last films in Star Wars in 1977. So, old Max Rosenberg and Milton Subotsky, the founders of Amicus, they finish up their series of anthology films in high form. This is a very good movie, folks. I'm going to warn some of you, if you haven't seen this movie right off the bat, I will spoil everything. There's no way I can talk about this film without spoiling everything about it. But as many of you know, and you know, based on some of the other ones that we've done, like The Asylum and Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, sometimes even if you know the ending, know the hooks and all the you know, the twists and turns that the movie takes, these are still a lot of fun to watch. So, just a warning, this is your chance now to go check this out. It's a very easy movie to find. It's out on all venues, DVD, Blu-ray. It's in a bunch of compilations. You can find it streaming. Now, a lot of the streaming services that I checked do charge a little bit of money for it. Again, this is another one of those $3.99 ones, but it's a lot of fun, folks. It's a lot of fun. Great music by Douglas Gamley and edited by John Ireland. And I mentioned John, this is not the actor John Ireland. This is the British editor John Ireland. I mentioned him, and I'm going to mention cinematographer Alan Hume, because it's a beautiful looking film and such a well edited film. So technically, these films are always done so well. And I think that's another thing that I really like about the storytelling when it comes to these anthology movies. Let's just quickly, I'm going to run down just a quick little list of some of the people that you're going to recognize from this film. And there can be a lot that you might not know the names of, but of course, Peter Cushing. What can we say about Peter Cushing? He was, you know, the face of Hammer for so many years as an actor. And of course, when Amicus started making their films, they would always run and get Peter. Peter would do 10 films for Amicus Productions. And I mean, there's just so much I could spend probably the whole rest of the show just talking about Peter Cushing. But he gives his usual solid performance. He plays the curator or the owner of a little antique store in sort of a rough part of London. And all of the stories center around people coming into this shop. And there's another thread that goes along throughout all of the little vignettes that you're going to see in From Beyond the Grave, and that is in every single episode, except for one, the character tries to put one over on Peter Cushing's character. Now, his character is never given a name, so I'm just going to call him the proprietor. I guess that would be the best way and most efficient way to identify his character. Now, some other people that you're going to see in this film, Donald Pleasance. Of course, Donald Pleasance, oh my God, all of the films that he was involved in over the years, you know, even non-horror films like The Great Escape, of course, sci-fis like Fantastic Voyage. I think, you know, I may have seen Donald Pleasance before then, but that may be where I really started, recognizing who he was. And he became a very favorite of all of ours. Just a great presence. I'm gonna back up a little bit on my comment on that, because I remember right now. Now that I have just sort of thought back, and you know, folks, I do a lot of the stream of consciousness, thinking back on Donald Pleasance. I think the first time that I am aware of Donald Pleasance and how much I enjoyed watching him on screen was in The Outer Limits. If you remember, it's one of my favorite Outer Limits episodes, The Power. And in this one, he plays a good guy in this, sort of in a sense. And yeah, here we go. You know, I don't want to spoil anything too early yet. But he plays a character, Jim Underwood, who's a former British soldier, fought in World War II, was decorated, sort of fallen on some hard times, as a lot of soldiers after World War II did. We will see him on a street corner selling shoelaces, and things of that nature, you know, just little knickknacks here and there, just trying to scratch out a living as best as he can, living with his daughter in a little flat, in sort of, you know, a rough part of London. And his daughter, in this case, in their segment, is played by Angela Pleasance. Yeah, that's his real-life daughter. She plays Emily. And that is one of my more favorite episodes within this anthology. And, you know, when we get to the storyline, this is one that I was absolutely really fond of. None of them really were bad episodes at all. That is the beauty of From Beyond the Grave, is like every one of the vignettes were really solid. Now, some of the other people that you're going to see, and you know, some of these names may be familiar, Ian Bannon and Ian Carmichael. We got a couple of Ians appearing in segments. Diana Doors. Interesting. I don't think we've had a chance to talk much about Diana Doors over the 8 years here in Monster Attack, but she was sort of Great Britain's answer to Marilyn Monroe. Was around for many years, had a very successful career, you know, big buxom platinum blonde, and she plays a sort of a shrew in this to one of our characters who was also a former military a military soldier during World War II in the British Army. And we'll get to we'll get to all of this when we get talking about each episode. Nyree Dawn Porter, another familiar name, another actor that I especially liked over the years, one of my favorite character actors. David Warner, this is one of the early films that I saw him in. And, of course, you remember him from Tron, and who could ever forget David Warner from Time After Time, which is a film that, folks, is on our list of movies to do very soon, because it is just such an outstanding film where he plays Jack the Ripper. No, I'm not spoiling anything. Everybody knew that on there. And I will also remember David Warner in a couple of Star Trek movies. He was in Star Trek V and Star Trek VI as two different characters. Of course, a friend of Monster Attacks, Ian Ogilvy, will be in the very last episode that we will see here. Of course, Ian, who was in the second rendition of The Saint, we had a chance to meet him, spend a weekend with him at Monsterama several years ago here in Atlanta. Really, really nice guy. And he is very young when this is one of his early, early films. Leslie Ann Down, I don't think we've had a chance to talk about her either. So a very, very pretty British lady. Yes, she was one that many of us were madly in love with when we saw her in films. And again, the people that Amicus is able to get for this film are amazing. I mean, this is amazing collection of characters. Jack Watson, another person that I know you'll recognize if you've watched any kind of British horror films or any kind of British dramas. He was a staple character actor in Great Britain for many, many years. Wendy Almott, Rosalind Ayers, Tommy Godfrey, Ben Howard, John O'Farrell, and Marcel Steiner. A fantastic cast to pick from in this great anthology movie, directed by Kevin O'Connor. Now, that name may be familiar to you. Kevin O'Connor, still with us. He's 86 years old, still living in London, England. Started out as a film editor, and this would be one of his earlier films. He would have directed one other film in 19, or he would have edited Oh, What a Lovely War, which he received a lot of accolades for. And by the time Beyond the Grave came around, Milton Szabonski tabbed him to direct, and he said, well, you know, I really haven't directed that much, I haven't done a feature film at all. And Milt says, "Hey, don't worry about it. You're going to do just fine. You're going to do just fine." And he does. He does a terrific job for this. Now, he did a lot of adventure films for Amicus, like The Land That Time Forgot. Another one that we did last season, At the Earth's Core, which we tied in with the Silver Scream Spook Show. The People That Time Forgot. If you remember that, sort of a sister film to The Land That Time Forgot. I love those movies. You know, movies like that. Even At the Earth's Core, with all of its problems. These were films that were just so much fun for me. Warlords of Atlantis and Arabian Adventure. All movies that we're going to be talking about here on Monster Attack down the road. And he also did some other fun movies. One in particular, folks, I'm not sure if it fits in with our Monster Attack motif. It's one of those, it's a little rough. We have done some R-rated films now over the past season and a half. But it's just one I especially loved from 1980, starring Rory Calhoun. And it's called Motel Hell. Maybe a little rough for what we do here at Monster Attack because it's very, very close to being a slasher film. But I'd like to hear from you guys on that, see what you think about Motel Hell, because it's one I would really, really like to do. Kevin O'Connor also did The House Where Evil Dwells, another favorite of mine growing up. And then some other non-horror films such as Sunset Grill and Domestic Imports. He also did a TV miniseries here in the United States, North and South Book 2. That's the second one of the North and South series. The Return of Sherlock Holmes, Great Expectations, Diana, Her True Story, Liz, the Elizabeth Taylor story, Mother Teresa, In the Name of God's Poor, In the Beginning, Frankenstein, Blackbeard, and Marco Polo. Some of the many, many television projects that he did as well. So a very, very accomplished director. And again, he does a terrific job on this. This movie moves very well. It is paced beautifully. I love the way, again, the way this film looks. He's got, like I said, great cinematographer. And the editor that he picked for this, John Ireland, just does a phenomenal job. And again, Douglas Gamley's music is outstanding. It everything works with this movie. And the amazing thing about this was, and Kevin O'Connor is talked about this in interviews he's done over the years, about how he had no money for this film. You know, Amicus would be pretty closed fist when it came to money on their movies. But folks, I got to tell you, over the years, for all of the films that they did, they really got their bang for the buck. So let's talk about From Beyond the Grave. And we're going to start with our first vignette called The Gate Crasher, starring David Warner. He starts by playing a character by the name of Edward Charlton. And I won't say necessarily he is an antique dealer, but he collects antiques. And he's always trying to get a deal, and he goes into this little shop. And this little shop is called Temptations LLC. And their logo on the door, which we really don't get a look at until the very end of the movie, but the logo on the door says, "Where we make offers you can't refuse." So it gives you sort of an idea, maybe there's something a little ominous about this going in. Well, Edward goes in, he sees this antique mirror that he really, really likes, asks the proprietor, "How much?" Proprietor says, £200, and he goes, "Oh, now that, this isn't an antique. I mean, I know you're saying it's antique, but, look at this and look at that, and it's clearly, a recreation. It's not authentic and all that. Tell you what, I'll give you £25 for it. Give you £25 for it and get it off your hands." And, of course, the proprietor's looking at him in the way that Cushing is so good at. And Edward goes, to himself, say, "Yeah, okay, never mind." He starts walking off, but the proprietor stops him and says, "Okay, you got a deal." So now you got Edward back at his flat in London with his girlfriend. And he's really thinking the most of himself because it's like, boy, did I get a deal. He's got some people over. They're having a little bit of a party. And someone says, hey, you know, that mirror looks like something you might see in a psychic medium's parlor and all that. And someone says, hey, we ought to have a seance. And Charles, Edward says, yeah, go clear off that table over there. Bring it into the middle of the room. We're going to have a seance. And they get candles and the whole nine yards, and they sit down at the table. They connect up their hands. They actually don't hold hands, but they connect up their fingers, finger to finger. And they hold a seance. I'm not going to go blow by blow on all of this, folks. Okay, I'm going to skip over a lot of the storylines, or we'd be here all day. But what a great way to open the film up, because all kinds of weird stuff goes on in this seance. And all of a sudden, Edward finds himself in a spirit world. Yeah, it's definitely in some other dimensional type thing. And this sinister creature tries to kill him. He's got this big knife and he tries to kill him. And just as the knife is plunging towards him, Edward screams out and all of a sudden he's back in his flat. Everybody's huddled around saying, are you okay? Are you okay? And he says, yeah, just a weird experience. And, of course, everybody leaves. And later that night, Edward's asleep, wakened from a deep sleep. And we see this sinister figure in the mirror. Yeah, he orders Edward to kill people because he needs to be fed. He needs blood. And Edward falls under his spell. And the first one to get killed is a prostitute that he picks up, and he, little by little, starts killing people until this apparition is able to, Edward at one point says, how much longer does this have to go on? I've become a killer, almost like a Jack the Ripper type killer, which is sort of ironic because David Warner would later play Jack the Ripper in Time After Time. But the sinister figure, the apparition, we'll call him, I guess, says, just have to feed me as long as it takes before I can get out of this mirror and manifest into the real world. Now, he almost gets Edward to kill his girlfriend. But Edward talks him out of that, says, no, I can't kill her. I can't kill her. But he does find someone to kill, like one of his neighbors. And the neighbor has a cat, and I was so afraid he was going to kill the cat, but he doesn't, thank God. No animals were killed in this movie, which is good. But Edward kills enough so that the figure comes out of the mirror and he says, Edward, I have something for you. An experience beyond the ultimate. That's the expression he uses. He says, but to do that, you have to go where no man would necessarily go. You have to experience the ultimate experience. And he's holding that big knife. And you can see that Edward is totally under his spell. And he says, pull yourself towards me and plunge yourself onto this knife. And Edward does and kills himself. And the apparition takes off. Now we see this little collage showing over the years, the apartment being remodeled, new wallpaper being cleaned up, all kinds of things. No signs of some of the brutal and gruesome murders that took place there before. When David Warner's character, Edward, was killing for this apparition. But we end up, this vignette, with a party. Young couple having some people over. And someone says, that is an interesting mirror. It looks like something that would be in a psychic medium's parlor. And someone goes, hey, let's have a seance. And they go, yeah, let's have a seance. And as the camera pulls away from the people grabbing this table to set it up for the seance, we see the mirror, and there's an apparition in the mirror. And, of course, have you guessed? Of course you have. It's Edward. As we see his apparition appearing in the mirror, looking out at these people getting ready to have this seance, and a little smirk going across his face like, oh, now it's my turn. So we go back now to our shop. That's a little story back and forth about a man who's being bullied by his wife. Character's name is Christopher Lowe. And Christopher, as we were telling you a while back, is a former British soldier in World War II. Of course, we find out that he didn't see any combat action. He basically was a pay officer, you know, in charge of making sure the soldiers got paid every week. Christopher Lowe is played by Ian Bannon, and he's married to Diana Doerr's character, Mabel. And Mabel is a real shrewd. A real, real shrewd. Now, he also has a son who, every time we see him, he's just like doing his homework, reading a book. Christopher gets no respect from his wife. He gets no respect from his son. But as he's walking to and from work, and he takes the subway every morning, and he befriends Jim Underwood. This is Donald Pleasance. You know, he's selling matches and shoelaces, you know, little knickknacks, things like that, just to make, you know, pennies here and there, but enough to live on. He's a decorated soldier. So Christopher, you know, brags about his military career. He says, oh, yeah, I was decorated too. Yeah, sure, I was. And Christopher, on his way home, passes the Temptation Shop and notices some British medals in the window and goes in, and there's a Distinguished Service Order. Now, it's like the Distinguished Service Cross we have here in the United States. Awarded for meritorious distinguished service and almost always in actual combat situations. But Lowe, again, was just a soldier in the pay corps. But he says, yeah, I lost mine. I want to replace it. And this is perfect. Of course, he wants to show it to Jim Underwood so they can convince him that he was awarded the DSO. But the proprietor says, well, do you have your certificate that proves that you received the award? And Lowe says, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, Christopher says, yeah, of course I do. It's at home. And the next time I'm in here, I'll bring it in and show it to you. But the proprietor says, okay, well, I'm going to set this medal aside for when you come back with your certificate. And then the proprietor leaves the room and goes off into another room, and Christopher opens up the little case that he put the medal in and steals it. So here we got our second person who has tried to get one over on the proprietor. And Christopher makes friends with Jim Underwood, who eventually invites him to his house for tea. He says, I want you to meet my daughter, Emily. And to make a long story short, Emily seduces Christopher. Now, Emily, this is Donald Pleasance's actual daughter. You know, she's sort of a plain Jane type guy. She's attractive, but in a very plain way. And over the period of several days, seduces Christopher, and they start a physical affair, leading to Emily showing him a miniature doll that she has made of Mabel, a voodoo doll. And she says, I will do whatever you want me to do. I will do whatever you command me to do. And you know, he's like a little Casper Miltos. He says, whatever you want to do. And she says, no, not what I want to do, what you want to do. And she's got this big needle in the doll's neck and says, I can plunge it in. And he says, yes, okay, do that. And then he thinks twice about it, and he goes rushing home, and he finds Mabel dead. She's dead. And then Jim Underwood and the daughter appear at Lowe's home. All of a sudden, we hear the sound of the wedding march, and it's like, oh, there's going to be a big wedding. And, of course, Emily and Christopher get married. And at the wedding reception, Jim tells Emily, cut the cake. But instead of cutting the cake, you know, the little groom and bride at the top of the cake, she cuts into the head of the groom, the top of the cake, and it looks like there's blood coming out of it. And all of a sudden we look at Christopher, and there's blood coming out of his head, and he falls over dead right into the cake. And Lowe's son's just looking there with a little smirk on his face. And Jim and Emily look at him, and Jim says, we always try to answer the prayers of a child in one way or another. And the end of that episode. Always a nice little hook at the end. So that when I was saying earlier Well, Jim sort of plays a good guy in this. Now that was one of my more favorite episodes. And that one was called An Act of Kindness. And I really, really, I think it, because of Donald Pleasance, I just love the way the whole thing plays out. Well, this next one is a lot of fun too. It's called The Elemental. You got a businessman. Character's name is Reggie Warren. And he's played by Ian Carmichael. He enters Temptations Limited. Sees a snuff box that he really likes, but there's two of them there. One very expensive and one that's not very expensive. And while the proprietor is in another room, well, how convenient is that all the time? He switches the price tags so that the cheaper price tag he puts into the snuff box that he wants to buy, the more expensive one. And the proprietor sells him the box at the lower price, doesn't catch it. But you know something's going on. The proprietor knows what's going on. And while on the train, Reggie meets Madame Orloff. This is one of the more interesting characters in this movie, played by a great British character actress by the name of Margaret Leighton. And Margaret made her career playing people like this. And she's going on and on and on about there's this elemental, the spirit on Reggie's shoulder. And she gives him her card and says, "You will need to call me if you need to, you want to get rid of this." And of course, when Reggie gets home, his dog goes nuts, barking at him like there's something going on, you know, because animals pick up on that sort of thing. Of course, Madame Orloff also said that. And his wife, Susan, is attacked by something. We don't know why. So he calls Madame Orloff, who has one of this. And again, I'm just going to tell you that it's a scene of exorcism to, you know, believe me. It's got some humor built into it. It's wild as all get out. And of course, Madame Orloff is a very over-the-top type character. And boom. She says, "I got rid of it." Well, later, Reggie and his wife keep hearing a noise coming from upstairs. Reggie says, "You stay here. I'm going to find out what it is." And he heads upstairs. We see him go up the stairs. The camera doesn't follow him upstairs, just shows him up there from a distance. And all of a sudden, we hear this noise, and Reggie comes falling down the stairs unconscious. And when he wakes up, he finds out that Susan is possessed by the elemental, who says, "You tried to deny me life, and you're going to pay for that." And the elemental kills Reggie and then smashes through the front door and takes off into the real world. End of the elemental. And that brings us to our fourth and final little vignette called The Door. And this is another favorite of mine. I think because it has Ian Ogilvy in it. And I really enjoyed meeting Ian. I hope he comes back to Monsterama someday, because he was so much fun to talk to. He plays a writer by the name of William Seaton, who finds his way into Temptations Limited. He sees this very ornate door. I mean, this is a big, thick door. It's got carvings in it, a face of, it looks like maybe a gargoyle on it or whatever. And his name is William Seaton, by the way. He's a writer. Doesn't have a whole lot of money. He says, "Boy, that is a beautiful door, and I know just where I would put it in my house. I've got a stationary cupboard it would be perfect for." And the proprietor says, quotes him an amount of money. And William doesn't have enough, and he says, "Look, this is all the money I have, and I'll give you everything. I'll give you every dollar I've got. I'll be broke, but I'll give you everything I've got if you'll accept this for the door. That's all I've got. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to buy it." And the proprietor says, okay. Opens up the till, sets the money there in the drawer. He doesn't close it, though. And he goes into the, he says, "Go into the next room and get your receipt." The camera's sort of focused on this money lying out there. And you're thinking, oh, boy. Here we go. And, of course, William gets the door. We see him install it in the stationery cupboard. And when his wife is played by Leslie Ann Down, when she touches it, she sees a vision of this very strange blue room. And the door itself becomes a portal into this blue room, which William decides, I'm going to explore this. And that leads him, you know, in this room to a table where there's a manuscript by a man by the name of Sir Michael Sinclair, who was a 17th century occultist, who created this room using human sacrifices. And periodically, Sinclair would lure people through the door so he can take their souls and live forever. And he abducts Rosemary, the wife, for his latest victim. And seeing done, you know, he's panic-stricken. He's got to save his wife, and then he gets an inspiration. And he realizes maybe everything is tied together with this magic door. And he races into his writing room, where he has all kinds of collections, all kinds of antiques and things like that. And he grabs this big axe that he has on the wall, and he starts hitting the door with it. And all of a sudden, wounds start appearing on Sinclair's body. And the chamber starts to fall apart, literally. I mean, the room is falling apart. And William fights with Sinclair, rescues Rosemary, and Rosemary helps him destroy the door completely, and Sinclair and the blue room just dissolve into nothingness. Now we cut back to the Temptations Limited. We're thinking all along, did William take some of his money back when the proprietor was out of there? Because last we've seen the proprietor, he's counting the money. So we're back now in Temptations where the proprietor is counting the money and says, there's no money missing. This was the one episode where someone came into Temptations and didn't try to rip off the proprietor. He honestly gave him all the money that he had, and he didn't justify trying to steal it back. So he comes out of it okay, as compared to the other people in these other vignettes. Now, along the way, in between scenes, we've seen this weird character sort of hanging around the shop. You know, he's up to no good. Real shady guy. And of course, we figure, okay, he's got to be in this somehow. And it's a little epilogue scene. And he enters the shop, and he tries to rob the proprietor. And this is Cushing at his very best, where he's like, yeah, go ahead. And he tries to shoot the proprietor, and invulnerable to gunfire. And the thief is blown away, and he doesn't know how to take this, and he's scared, and he starts slowly walking back, and he trips and he falls into this large box. It's filled with spikes. And of course, you know, it's like some medieval torture device. And the proprietor's just like, why do people have this greed for money? Because it always gets them in trouble. And then we hear the door to the shop open up and the little bell go off, you know, signaling the proprietor that someone's there. And it's a point of view shot now where we are the next customer. And of course, again, Peter Cushing in all of his greatest, saying, yes, this is a shop that caters to all tastes. And after each purchase comes a big novelty surprise. Surprise! From beyond the grave. I'm going to mention some of the other people that were in these episodes. Again, The Gate Crasher, starring David Warner. Wendy Almet played the girlfriend Pamela. This is where we see Rosalind Ayers. She was the prostitute that's killed first. You'll also see Tommy Godfrey and Marcel Steiner. Marcel Steiner plays the demon in The Mirror. An Act of Kindness, of course, Ian Bannon as Christopher Lowe and Donald and Angela Pleasance as Jim and Emily Underwood. Diana Doors as Mabel. I didn't mention John O'Farrell. He plays Stephen Lowe, who is the young son of Christopher and Mabel Lowe. Ian Carmichael plays Reggie in The Elemental, Margaret Leighton as Madame Orloff, who's one of my favorite characters in this movie. And then Nyree Dawn Porter played Susan Warren, who was Reggie's wife. And one thing, you know, there were little throwaway lines in The Elemental that I really like where Madame Orloff says, be careful of your wife, watch her because she's hot stuff. And boy, these elementals, they really like that sort of thing. Sort of giving it all away. And then, of course, we've got Ian Ogilvy and Leslie Ann Down and Jack Watson. We mentioned Jack Watson. Like I said, you're going to recognize him. He's the one that plays Sir Michael Sinclair, the magician from the reign of Charles II. And then Ben Howard is the fellow, the sort of sinister-looking fellow hanging around the shop. This is a fun, fun movie. It's based on a series of stories that Milton Subotsky found. One of them was The Elemental and Other Stories by R. Chetwin Hayes, who also wrote The Cold Terror and The Unbidden. And all of these stories make up the four main stories that we see in From Beyond the Grave. Folks, these are so much fun. And I was a big fan, and still am a big fan of Amicus Productions, because I loved these types of productions. I love them, these anthology productions. And like I said, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, at a very young age, I mean, I was only about 9 or 10 years old when I first saw that. It influenced me in so many ways in the writing that I would do later on in my life. I love this type of storytelling. I don't know if I'm too old now, but if somehow I get the opportunity to make another film, I sure would like to. I would love to make a film like this. I really would. I would really love to make an anthology type movie because I love the storytelling in this. I can't recommend this enough. And I think Amicus goes out on a high note with the high note they set when they started with their very first anthology series, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors. This is a terrific film, folks, and one well worth looking at. Again, even if you haven't seen the movie and you sat and listened to me giving it all away here on this episode, it's still well worth watching. From Beyond the Grave, 1974, Happy Birthday, celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. Boy, does that bring back memories for me too. Yeah. Sophomore year in college. And again, I was, you know, like I was saying in so many other shows, I was living in this little movie theater on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Still there. And it's still there in Chapel Hill. So folks, enjoy From Beyond the Grave. Hey folks, we're going to be back with Shane and Madeline on next week's episode of Monster Attack. At least so far, all's looking well. Now, I've got a crazy schedule going on with my knee surgery coming up. But Shane and Madeline, it looks like I think we're going to be able to get together and do the Godzilla movie, Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, which is going to be tied in with their Silver Scream Spook Show, which is coming up on the 20th of April. If you're in the Atlanta area listening to this episode when it was first released, come join us for that. They're always a lot of fun. Our second one of the new year. Folks, we wish you the very, very best of weeks. And we will see you again next Monday. Have a good one, folks.
Check out the Modern Musicology podcast, where each week we talk about things like
what makes a great drummer,
our favorite rock documentaries,
songs we love by artists we don't love,
our favorite concert memories,
songs that should have been singles,
and all of our favorite music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now.
Do not use Modern Musicology if you're allergic to it. Modern Musicology may produce itching, dizziness, vertigo, temporary blindness, or heart palpitations. Do not taunt Modern Musicology.
Ask your doctor about switching to Modern Musicology.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.